On ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, The Country Hour with Larissa Smith.
Hi there, in the Country Hour chair for another week. Nice to have you along this Monday. How do you know if the honey you're spreading on your toast in the morning is the real deal? Cracking honey fraud in Australia, that story ahead. Plus, streamlining tests for Pacific Oyster Mortality Syndrome. Growers will soon have access to machinery to test their own oysters for POMS.
What we've been looking at is a field test with about an average cost of, they're quoting $2 a sample. So that would make my overall batch testing of 30 samples a grand total about $60 instead of nearly a couple of grand. So that means that we could just test a lot more, which from a biosecurity perspective is a holy grail.
And frustration mounting over calls to keep export hay in the country for drought-affected farmers.
You cannot just turn export markets on and off. So if we were to turn our export fodder industry off at any time, it's gone.
Hay exports a little later, but we'll start with horticulture this afternoon because Tasmania's reputation as a national supplier of berries has been given another injection of confidence. UK berry breeding company Berry World has joined forces with Queensland farmers Pinata Farms to establish a new berry farm on a greenfield site in southern Tasmania. The purchase now means that global berry breeding companies from both the UK and the US have invested in the state. Lee Peterson, formerly of Macquarie Franklin, is the technical manager for Berry World Tasmania, and he told Sally Dacus they see continuing global growth in berry consumption.
Oh, Tasmania will be an integral part of our national production, basically. So we already have partner growing Pinata Farms in Queensland. Specifically, it will be berries and predominantly raspberries is where the focus will be with Berry World raspberry varieties. Our varieties are actually bred by the Berry World Group in UK and there's a continuous breeding program going on there in the UK, and in the case of strawberries also in as well as UK and in Spain. And really it's all about actually producing the best berries that we can. We're all about taste, flavour and a good shelf life raspberry or strawberry, and that's what we're really all about. We're all about actually producing a really high quality berry.
But in terms of global berry breeding, it is interesting we're getting strong international collaboration, but it does introduce more diversity into the Australian market with Berry World's varieties. Do you see it as that?
Most definitely. I mean, Berry World, you know, is very established in Europe. Now, throughout Europe, you know, Berry World is a very, very large producer. And this is, you know, a new sort of a subsidiary, really, of the Berry World Group to actually come to Australia. Admittedly, we probably are a little bit behind the eight ball. And as you say, there's people such as Driscoll's, but there's also American Genetics and all here as well with other companies. So we're not the only kid on the block, but we like to think that we're really sort of striving to actually be the best kid on the block long term.
We've been talking about raspberries and strawberries, but will there be other varieties that you'll be testing that could be future crops in the berry market?
Really, that will predominantly be blackberries. One of the downsides of actually bringing in genetics from overseas is that it's a very long process, because you send a couple of plants into quarantine and they disappear for a couple of years. And then once you've got them out of quarantine and the virus tested, you can then start multiplying. So it's a very long process. So we're really only just starting to get commercial volumes now of raspberries and strawberries, but the blackberries are a little bit behind. They're still within quarantine. So the whole process really takes about 4 or 5 years before we can actually get to commercial material, and that's where we're starting to get to now.
What does your company see for the berry market? It's been experiencing exponential growth for maybe 10 years or so now. Can that continue?
I think so. I mean, I think the litmus test for that is to look at the head of population consumption in European countries versus Australia. When you compare that, as a berry-eating nation, we've got a long way to go. So I think there's still a lot of room in the market.
We've seen Tasmania battling with outbreaks of fruit fly in northern Tasmania. Is that an issue that concerns growth?
It certainly is, and that is another reason to be a little bit different and going down south. We see that as helping us a little bit with managing biosecurity risk.
Let's get down to nuts and bolts. You're based at Orielton. Tell us about the operation. Is it a greenfield site?
Yes, that's a complete greenfield site. We really only took possession of that 2 weeks ago. It's just basically a dry land block of land that is being connected up to the southeast irrigation stage two. And it's quite good in a way because we actually have a blank sheet of paper where we can actually put together what we actually want from a production basis and also then from a packaging and handling point of view with cool rooms and so forth.
Yeah. And we're talking about protected cropping here. This is all going to be undercover, is it?
Yes, it will be. It will be all under polytunnels. That's correct. Really, that's a necessity these days to actually mitigate against risk. Whilst Tasmania has low rainfall relative to, say, where our Queensland, some of our Queensland production is, it's all still about actually producing the best quality berry that we can by using all of the tools of the trade that we can to actually protect the crop.
Lee Peterson, formerly of Macquarie Franklin. He's the technical manager for Berrywell Tasmania, establishing a new covered berry farm at Orielton in southern Tasmania. Well, the oyster industry could soon have access to new machinery that could help detect Pacific oyster mortality syndrome. Currently, farmers have to send samples off, but the new machine can be used anywhere. Brooke Neindorf has the story.
For an oyster farmer to have a water sample tested for Pacific oyster mortality syndrome, they have to send it off farm to a lab, which not only costs them time, but it can also cost them plenty of money. But the new test that's being developed at South Australia's Flinders University could see them have results back in under an hour and for as little as $2 per sample. The machine is called a flow cytometer, is about the size of a toaster and can be used out by the oyster racks or back in the shed. James Patterson from Flinders University explains.
Basically, it's a particle counter. So we've bought this machine off the shelf and developed a protocol that we can specifically and accurately target the POMS virus in a range of different samples.
So how would an oyster grower use this?
So, for example, they could be use it in monitoring terms, so collecting seawater around their leases and doing daily tests on whether the virus is present in the water.
Mr. Patterson says they've been developing the test for about a year now, and it simply came about because oyster farmers needed a way to test for POMS. He said it's not cheap to set up the machine initially, but they've already had a lot of interest.
I think it's about $18,000. It's off the shelf, very, very easy to set up. And then the consumables and reagents are an extra cost, but they're, compared to the machine, very, very minimal.
For a grower to do a sample, how much would that sort of roughly cost each time?
Around about $2. It's not much. Yep. So, and time-wise, you know, you're sort of looking at within an hour, you've got an exact result.
Is it something that a growing bay... Like a whole heap of growers could pitch in, buy one of these machines and then come and do their own samples, or do you have to keep the different leases separate?
No, I don't think so. I think that's probably an option for sure. It'd be important that someone is responsible for the machine in looking after it. It doesn't get abused. It's not bulletproof, but it is very, very easy to use. So if someone's there just keeping an eye on it, that's certainly an option to share the costs.
James Patterson from Flinders University. Lisa Dan has also been working on the new sample test and says they're trying to make it as easy as possible for anyone to use.
This machine is can easily be brought into the field, so it's just a matter of taking your sample of interest, so whether it's seawater or some oyster tissue, popping that into a tube, adding a couple of reagents and then popping it into the machine, and you get your result then and there. So there shouldn't be much need to have to go back to a laboratory or somewhere else or outsource. You can just do all of your stuff there and then. So, yeah, it's extremely streamlined. So, it's very easy to use. Just basically step one, step two, step three, and you're done. So, yeah.
So if the results of POMS came up, what would pop up if there was POMS present?
So with the machine, you have an actual visual interface on the front. So we've set up the machine in a way so that there's different regions on a graph that will show you whether there's a presence or an absence of the virus. So straight away, you'll see whether there's a signal coming up in the presence point. And then from there, you can say that you have detected some POMs. And then the amount of particles that you see in that region will let you know whether there's a high concentration or a low concentration or somewhere in between as well. So,
can it be used for detecting anything else?
Yeah, so the beauty of this machine is that this can be optimised for all different types of pathogens, so any type of bacteria, virus, fungal, basically anything that you want to count particle-wise, this machine can be used to do that as well. So, yeah.
Ben Cameron is an oyster farmer from Tasmania, but is also the chairman of the new Yumbar Hatchery based in Port Lincoln, which is providing oyster spat to growers in South Australia. He says it's great news to be able to have such a rapid and cheap test available to growers.
For us, it'd be exceptional if we can get it in and implement it as part of an overarching overall biosecurity plan. I mean, at the moment, we've got policy documents, policy procedures, staff training, and that's the process, but I guess the confirmation that all of that's been successful right the way through could be done with a machine like this for a very, very low cost compared with what we're paying at the moment. It'd just be a game changer for biosecurity in oysters.
What are you currently doing at the moment?
At the moment, if we want to do testing of oysters, we have to, in Tasmania, we have to send off a sample of oysters to a government lab. There's a fairly long lead time. The preparation of the samples is not too lengthy, but is arduous. You've got freight and logistics, samples get lost, and then we're paying other professionals, you know, the highly skilled, highly trained technicians, a lot of money to run these samples, whereas this here is what we've been looking at is a field test with about an average cost of, they're quoting $2 a sample, so that would make my overall batch testing of 30 samples a grand total about $60 instead of nearly a couple of grand. So that means that we could just test a lot more, which from a biosecurity perspective is a holy grail, really.
And do you think it would be something that you could put at site and most people could use it from your understanding of just having a bit of a chat there?
Yeah, we'd definitely be very, very keen to fully understand the training and the what goes into making sure these tests are accurate first time, every time. So, yeah, we'd really like to have a good look at that. And assess how efficient and effective it would be just for the general technicians on the farm sites, absolutely.
Tasmanian oyster grower Ben Cameron, he's also the chairman of the new Yumbar Hatchery based in Port Lincoln in South Australia, and he was speaking with Brooke Neindorf.
Hello, Helen Shield. No. Yes, with ABC Radio Hobart, we'll be broadcasting live from the Claremont RSL to support our Tasmanian competitors for the Invictus game. Join your afternoon with Helen Shield, joined by special guest John X, that's me, from 1:30 p.m. Tuesday 4th of September to meet our competitors and hear local stories of courage and resilience.
Helen Shield, tomorrow afternoon from 1:30 on ABC Radio Hobart.
That's really all the info required. See you there.
It's the Country Hour with Larissa Smith on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
Well, Australia's biggest listed honey company and some of the country's largest supermarket chains face accusations of unwittingly selling fake honey. Testing at a leading international scientific lab that specialises in honey fraud detection has found that almost half the honey samples selected from supermarket shelves were adulterated, meaning it's been mixed with something other than nectar from bees. David Claughton reports.
The adulterated samples were all products that blend local and imported honey. The ABC's 7:30 report spoke to Quality Services International, based in Germany, which tested the honey.
Why is honey adulterated? Of course, it's a cost question, yeah? It's a cost question. I mean, in China, it's centuries, I would say, tradition, and they are openly admitting, yeah, if you want to buy a pure honey, you have to pay a higher price, yeah. And if you want to have a product for a low price, you get a product which you think it's honey, but it's not honey.
Honey producers in Australia have been concerned about the issue for a long time, but have lacked hard information on practices overseas. Kieran Sunderland is a beekeeper in Dubbo in New South Wales.
From a little bit I've seen, they're using all types of cheap syrups, like whether it's sugar syrup, rice syrup. They're running like 50,000 hives of bees in sheds and feeding them these syrups. And every 3 days they pull it off the bees because the bees have added the enzymes to the honey. And then they're running it through dehydrators to bring the moisture down again. But it's all rumour and gossip and nothing. No one's got anything ironclad on them.
He says the presence of fake honey is putting price pressures on everyone in the industry.
Yeah, as a producer and retailer of our own product, we are seeing that, you know, we can't compete at that pricing level that they can sell their products for. Even the fact that they're such a large supplier themselves, you know, they've got an economy of scale, but when they're using an even cheaper product, and these products are coming in at, you know, a third of the price of what it cost us to produce the honey.
Capilano's Alowry-branded mixed blossom honey, sold as 100% honey, showed up as adulterated in the majority of samples tested. Capilano strongly denies any issues with its products and criticised the type of test, known as nuclear magnetic resolution. It's used to detect impurities, but it differs from the official Australian test. Jodie Goldsworthy from Beechworth Honey says the industry wants the test to be adopted, but regardless of what's being used, fake honey producers are constantly working to get around the system.
It's very similar to the drugs in sport problem in some ways. The adulterators keep one step ahead of the laboratories and the testing methods, but there's been a pretty significant breakthrough with the development of the NMR test. And it provides a fingerprint for honey. So instead of a targeted test like has been used in the past, where it can only identify one particular parameter and test for a particular sugar, the NMR test actually is able to test for around 200 different parameters. And so as soon as something foreign, like a fake syrup that doesn't belong in honey is added, it changes the profile and changes the way that that honey looks. And that's being compared to, you know, a database with known honeys that are honey, and that's how the laboratories are actually determining that. And currently, Australia doesn't use that test. So the Australian Honeybee Industry Council certainly did request the government, and I guess, you know, we're waiting for hopefully that to occur as part of that. But I think the interesting thing is that supermarkets, certainly some supermarkets in other parts of the world, Carrefour, we understand, and some of the Australian supermarkets are certainly, you know, looking at this test.
There's no suggestion that Capilano's brand of Australian-sourced honey has any issue, or that Capilano or other brands were aware of the adulteration. Jodie Goldsworthy says the key message for consumers is that they can feel safe consuming purely Australian honey.
It's great to reassure consumers that this is a problem about imported honey from China, not Australian honey. Australian honey from Australian beekeepers from trustworthy sources can be trusted.
Jodie Goldsworthy from Beechworth Honey, who spoke to John Fain. David Claughton filed that report. You can see more on this Fairfax ABC 7:30 investigation tonight. 0467 922 917. How often do you check the back label of your honey jar? What do you think of honey fraud and fake honey? Should it be happening in this era of technology and testing? 0467 922 917. Send me in your thoughts about honey fraud and fake honey. Well, moving along to hay exports now, and calls are growing louder for the federal government to seize hay earmarked for export so it can be given to drought-stricken farmers. But hay exporters say it would seriously damage an important industry and Australia's reputation abroad. Jess Davis explains.
With no end to the drought in sight, CEO of the Australian fodder industry, John McHugh, says hay supplies are close to running out.
There's always going to be some hay in the system, but in terms of what's available commercially, we're about as low now as you'd want to go.
It sparked a debate over whether the federal government should be able to seize hay earmarked for export and instead give it to drought-stricken farmers struggling to feed their stock.
We all understand the devastating effect of the drought, but to actually you know, place, I suppose, an onus on an industry, a legitimate commercial industry, to actually be able to alleviate this problem is an oversimplification of the issue completely.
Over the last week, social media has been awash with posts like this one.
It should not be being exported. It should be sent to our farmers. Another example of our governments looking after other countries before our own.
But hay producer Luke Femlingham says seizing hay for export isn't the answer.
Certainly gaining a lot of momentum on social media. There's probably people frustrated that they hear stories. You know, there's so many thousand tonnes available and it's been exported to China and Japan. And then they're sort of jumping on the bandwagon quite quickly and making their own assumptions, which I think is unfair.
Around 10 to 15% of Australian fodder is exported each year, with most of that already tied up in contracts.
You're attacking the hand that feeds you. Exporters are letting hay go domestically as well. To rob from an industry, it might seem like short-term damage, but it's really going to hurt the industry long-term, I think.
John McHugh says a move to seize hay would damage an industry that has been built up over decades. He says breaking contracts would ruin Australia's reputation as a reliable supplier.
You cannot just turn export markets on and off. So if we were to turn our export fodder industry off at any time, it's gone.
And he says when the drought breaks, the domestic market will be flooded with excess hay.
If we use the 2017 figures, that's 1.2 million metric tonne extra fodder into the domestic market. Prices will go down even further and we'll have fodder growers who are going to be in desperate situations.
But South Australian hay broker Alistair Turner says exporters should be releasing more hay into the domestic market.
The exporters don't seem to be interested in, and obviously they have their overseas contracts and things they've got to fill. But if we could work together to redirect some of the supply and help short-term crisis, that would be an ideal situation.
He says seizing the hay would be a draconian measure.
They would have to declare a state of emergency before something could be forced there, but a forced move like that would have, you know, ramifications all the way around. It could be quite damaging, yes.
National Farmers Federation President Fiona Simpson says governments shouldn't interfere with the free market.
So really, you know, what's going to happen when we eat that? We're still going to be in the same position that we're in now.
John McHugh agrees.
And I would argue at the moment if we were to confiscate every bale of hay that every exporter had in the country, it wouldn't go very far at the moment to feeding anything.
CEO of the Australian Fodder Industry Association, John McHugh. Ending that story by Jess Davis. And the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, has told AM that the federal government has no plan to force compulsory acquisition of hay. Coming up after the news and weather, we'll head across the ditch and look at lamb production in New Zealand. Why Kiwi sheep producers are continuing to pull out of the industry and move into beef and dairy. What will this mean for lamb exporters here in Australia? You'll find out in about 15 minutes from now. Well, switching back to horticulture, and backpackers would prefer to serve coffee in Sydney than pick fruit in Victoria's Goulburn Valley. That's according to the general manager of Geoffrey Thompson Orchards, Brent Reeve, who says it's getting tougher to find workers. He says his company is now moving towards robotics to help with the worker shortage.
So at Geoffrey Thompson's, we have 750 hectares of orchard at the moment. We're looking towards the future and are growing every year, and we're planting approximately 30 hectares every year at the moment and looking to increase that because we're looking for the future and we think there is a great export market out there and opportunities for us to export more fruit.
And what varieties are you planting?
At the moment we're still planting Gala and we're planting some new red-coloured blushed pears and looking at other newer varieties that will be coming into the market soon.
In this region around Shepparton, what do you think the biggest challenges facing fruit growers are?
Around here, definitely the climate and climate change is one of the key things that is a problem here. Fruit fly, which we have got under control, but majority of people have anyway, but that's a key thing. in the industry around here as well.
So as a major player in fruit growing in Victoria, what are you guys doing differently, or is there any challenges that you guys are trying to overcome at the moment?
Definitely the things that we're trying to overcome at the moment is labour. So we're looking at anything we can do to reduce our labour. So robotics is high on the agenda, and newer planting for robotics, so as we can utilise those when they do come available. So that is one of the major things that we're looking at the moment.
When you talk about robotics and having it take over from labour, that just sounds like, you know, it's less employment opportunities.
It's probably the reality of the future. You know, there's the harvesting of the fruit is so extensive that we struggle to get enough people. So it's not as if that we're going to be taking jobs away from people. There's not the people out there that want to do that that task, and it's very difficult to get those people to do that task. So robotics coming in is, you know, we're struggling to get backpackers anymore that want to do the task. The backpackers would rather go to Sydney and work in a cafe. That's what we're finding.
At Geoffrey Thompson, is there a particular fruit or a particular change that you've noticed in the past year or that you expect to see in the next 2 years?
Definitely pink ladies have, you know, probably hit their peak. There's enough of those grown within Australia at the moment. So the biggest thing that we're looking at the moment is export, trying to export more of our varieties. And also William pears and Packham pears. It's you know, pears are a problem at the moment, trying to sell them domestically. So hopefully we can find some more export markets soon.
That was Geoffrey Thompson, Orchard's General Manager Brent Reeve, talking to Megan Ruth. And in the next 20 minutes or so, farm technology, we'll talk more about that, to reaching new heights.
Current technology means that farmers have to walk around the farm once a week, say, and that takes 2 to 3 hours to measure the whole farm. So by measuring by satellite, we can remove that labour or transfer that labour to another part of the farm.
Keeping tabs on pasture growth using satellites, plus robots designed by farmers for farmers.
The idea is this machine can go out in a field and perform a range of tasks depending on the attachments or the application that individual farmers have choose to develop.
Horticulture innovation weighing up the benefits of robots for apple orchards, not obviously only in northern Victoria, but more broadly for the horticulture sector across the country. Now to the weather outlook for today. Let's check in with Luke Johnston at the Bureau. Much rain around, Luke?
No, it's not been much at all, really. I've had a little bit about the western and central districts, mainly yesterday, but not a whole lot around today. Got a high pressure system just sitting to our west, and that's going to slowly move over us by this evening. So very light winds around, maybe some light showers about the west and far south today, but they're very, very small and there shouldn't really be much in them.
So it sounds like a nice spring day then.
Perfect spring day, actually. It's going to continue into tomorrow, although showers become a little bit more likely about the north tomorrow, and most likely about the higher ground in the north, so on the faces of the Western Tiers and the Northeast Highlands. But fine elsewhere in the south of the state tomorrow, and there will be quite a bit of frost around tomorrow morning as well. Very similar to this morning, but perhaps a touch less. And winds tomorrow, instead of being a bit more light and fluffy and variable, they'll be a little bit more northeast to northwesterly, as that high now is sitting in the Tasman Sea. Rainfall-wise tomorrow, not much. Along the north coast, less than a millimetre, and only around 2 millimetres or so about those elevated areas in the north.
What about for the rest of the week, looking ahead on the long-range models?
Yeah, sure. Well, on Wednesday, we see winds start to freshen a little bit from the north. Showers about the north continue and extend a little bit further south into central districts. Rainfall-wise, we're looking around about 5 millimetres or so, 5 to 10 millimetres are those elevated areas in the north, and very little reaching the south or the east of the state on Wednesday. On Thursday, there's a cold front coming through later in the day. We'll see periods of rain about the north and west, with showers extend to remaining parts during the day, but not a whole lot reaching the southeast. About the north, though, we'll see probably around 10 to 20 millimetres, a little bit more, or probably close to double that around the Western Tiers, and about the west, 5 to 10 millimetres. But like I said, not really much reaching into the southeast, unfortunately. On Friday, there'll be showers about the northwest and far south. There's a second cold front coming through, so one Thursday afternoon, and then another one Friday morning, and then those showers will contract to the west during the evening on Friday. So mainly fine about the east on Friday as well.
And what sort of temperatures can we expect?
Temperatures will slowly climb from what they are today. Today we're looking at temperatures in the mid-teens. Tomorrow a degree or two warmer. Peaking on Thursday before the cold front comes through, potentially into the high teens, we may even see some very, very low 20s.
Ooh.
And then temperatures begin to drop down again on Friday after the second cold front comes through.
Who's getting the 20s?
Oh, it'd be the East Coast for sure, I reckon. They're always nice at this time of the year if you're looking for temperatures going to the East Coast. But unfortunately, it's probably going to be relatively dry there too.
Okay. Coastal waters and swell.
All right. Coastal waters today, westerly winds down south, only 10 to 20 knots, decreasing during the evening. But everywhere else, variable winds around 5 to 15 knots and seas below 2 metres. Tomorrow, northeast to northwesterly, still relatively on the light side at 5 to 15 knots, increasing to 10 to 20 knots in the afternoon and evening, though. But those winds are expected to increase even further on Wednesday. So without jumping too far ahead of myself, there are no coastal wind warnings out today or tomorrow. So that doesn't happen all the time in Tassie. In fact, it's quite uncommon these days. Onto the swell, the west and south, southwesterly near 3 metres, decaying to 2 to 3 metres during tomorrow. And our wave rider boy at the moment's currently saying 3.5 metres, but the trend is definitely to decrease. And Matsaika Island this morning was a southwesterly at 4 metres, Bruny Island a southerly at 3 metre swell. So hopefully everything's on the ease. Across the north, we've got a westerly swell below a metre, much below half a metre in the east of the north. And up the east coast, a southerly around 1 metre, although tending southwesterly 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south.
Too easy. Is that it?
Yeah.
Luke, that's a wrap.
One more thing to mention. Tomorrow morning, there's likely to be some ice around on the roads, probably similar to this morning. So I'm seriously considering, I think I will issue a road weather alert, just warning for ice on susceptible roads tomorrow morning. So do take care, everyone.
And we'll keep an eye out for that. Thank you, Luke.
Thanks.
Luke Johnson there at the Bureau.
Hello, Helen Shield. No. Yes, with ABC Radio Hobart, we'll be broadcasting live from the Claremont RSL to support our Tasmanian competitors for the Invictus game. Join your afternoon with Helen Shield, joined by special guest John X, that's me, from 1:30 p.m. Tuesday 4th of September to meet our competitors and hear local stories of courage and resilience.
Helen Shield, tomorrow afternoon from 1:30 on ABC Radio Hobart.
That's really all the info required. See you there.
On ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, this is The Country Hour with Larissa Smith.
Where it's 21 minutes away from 1 o'clock. The continued decline in New Zealand's lamb production is likely to fall back onto Australian exporters to fill the gap in supply. Recent surveys have forecast lamb numbers across the ditch to drop around 4% to 22 million head as more Kiwi farmers make the switch to beef and dairy cattle. Mercado's Matt Dalgleish says Australia's chief competitor for sheep meat has been losing key breeding stock for some time.
Probably from around 2007, 2008, we started to see a bit of a decline in the New Zealand flock, the total flock, and that's basically off the back of a reduction in the level of their breeding years, and obviously that then flows through to the total the lamb crop each year. So you do sometimes in that period, say from 2008 to present in the last 10 years, have seen from time to time the lamb crop has increased, but generally speaking, the trend's been down.
What's the reason behind it?
Well, there has been a shift. Obviously, New Zealand's has been quite well known for their dairy produce, and dairy is a big industry there, but over the last 10 years or so, we have seen a shift away from sheep production and into beef cattle as well. So that's probably been what's kind of a bit of a fight for acres there in New Zealand for those two competing industries of beef and sheep meat.
The New Zealand stock number survey has been released in the last few months. Out of that, is it likely that the numbers will continue to fall in the next 12 months or so?
Yeah, that's right. So the results of that survey show that in terms of the total New Zealand flock, it's going to be down about 0.8%. And the lamb crop, I guess, is the bigger drop. It's a 3.8% decline for the lamb crop for this coming season. And that's really on the back of a drop in those breeding ewes, like I said before. So the breeding ewes, they're expecting a decline in about around 2.1% of breeding ewes. So, and if you contrast that to over the same time frame, what they're expecting for beef cattle, are seeing nearly a 2% increase for beef cattle. So you can see that kind of transition away from sheep and into beef there, just in the stats for the next year.
So with that transition, what does it mean for Australian lamb exporters?
Oh, look, when you look at it from a global perspective, realistically, Australia and New Zealand we do supply that 70% of the global export sheep meat market, and at the moment it's approximately a 35% split either way, so we're about 35% each, give or take. But over the forecast for the next few years, with this decline in the New Zealand flock, we're seeing that Australia is going to start to overtake New Zealand in terms of how much we're supplying. And you know, from that perspective too, if you've got only two real main suppliers for the world effectively, which is Australia and New Zealand, and they're our only real competitor, any offshore markets, say such as parts of Asia where the demand for sheep meat's growing, if one supplier is reducing there, what they've got available, they've got to go to another alternative, and realistically the only alternative from New Zealand sheep meat is Australia. So it's going to increase the demand for our product.
Does Australia have the capacity to fill that shortfall when numbers have fallen this season with the drought in a number of states?
Yes, look, certainly. We had been in Australia up until recently. We had been in a flock rebuild. With this drought, we have seen the key number there is what we call the sheep, the turnoff figure for sheep offtake, and that includes how many sheep are being slaughtered in Australia plus what are being exported live. And that figure, just in the last few months, has trickled back into a region that's consistent with a flock decline now. But look, that's really just a temporary setback. I think certainly the incentive from Australia is as soon as the season changes more favourably again, we'll swing back into a flock rebuild phase again. So from a longer-term perspective, this drought, as long as it doesn't last for years and years and continues to eat away at the flock, we're likely to get back into the swing of things and start to rebuild the flock again. And it could come as early as later this year or early next year, when it certainly looks like on some of the longer range forecasts we're going to head into a bit more of a normal late spring and potentially a more normal summer for rainfall. So that'll give sheep producers in Australia the incentive to start to rebuild again.
So with more of a reliance on the Australian market in a couple of years' time, if the equilibrium shifts, does that put producers in a better position to possibly bargain for a higher price?
Oh, look, I think we're already seeing, if you look at some of the incredible prices we're seeing now for lamb and indeed mutton as well around the country, and that's largely driven by that offshore demand. Just this year, we're seeing quite a significant increase in demand for both lamb and mutton out of Asia, something like around 16% higher this year than the five-year average for demand for lamb for mutton, and about 35% higher this year than over the five-year average for the demand for lamb. So, and that's just coming out of Asia. So with that kind of growth already we're seeing in that demand for this year, and combine that with the supply scenario out of New Zealand and what we've had in the drought, we've seen the impact on price already this season. If we continue to see, and certainly the forecast for Asian demand is that it's going to continue to grow into the next 5 years at least, that's going to be a significant force in underpinning good solid lamb prices for the next few years to come.
Matt Dalgleish, market analyst with Mercado, talking about the drop-off in lamb production in New Zealand. We'll be chatting about robots in the orchard, what's happening in the research space, and farmers producing robots for other farmers, a Queensland company working in that area. More about that in about 5 minutes' time. Well, you can do pretty much anything with an app these days, including watching grass grow from space. Tasmanian Oliver Roberts created an app that combines daily satellite imagery and farm data to give farmers an idea of how much grass is in each paddock. He told Margot Kelly remote monitoring can help farmers make better decisions about one of the key profit drivers, and that's pasture.
So the satellites fly across the farm daily and they take images of the landscape, and through those images there are different optical metrics that we utilise and tap into. What we do is we combine those optical images with all the metadata with our farm records to then produce how much biomass is in each paddock.
How do you figure that out?
Okay, so there are different spectral bands within spatial images such as red light and near infrared. And from those spectral bands, we're able to calculate things like NDVI. And from NDVI basically measures greenness. And from greenness, we can get a rough or a crude estimate of how much biomass there is or how much pasture is in a paddock. On top of modelling and feedback with farm records, we're able to make that even more accurate by using machine learning techniques such as neural networks to get that measurement a lot more accurate and consistent.
How did you actually get involved with a satellite?
The technology in satellites has increased along with the technology of everything else over time. And what's great about recent advances is there's a lot more satellites in the sky, and the resolution of those satellites is a lot finer. This means that we're able to use these satellites to make timely measurements of, say, farm management measurements. The satellites of yesteryear had really coarse resolution, which they flew less regularly, which means that if there's cloud cover or something like that, we might miss out a satellite measurement from 8 days to 16 days. Whereas the satellites now that are flying daily, if it's cloudy, we can pick up tomorrow's day that is not cloudy.
And it's able to even isolate, you know, one or two separate paddocks and give you feedback on that?
Exactly.
Does this remove the need for farmers to walk the paddocks?
To a certain degree, it removes the need for farmers to walk the paddocks. Farmers invariably will be on farm and will be checking out what's happening in the paddocks anyway, such as when cows are being herded for milking or just driving through the farm to set gates or to fix irrigation, for example. But the farmer's eye is an integral part of making the satellite technology better in that their feedback helps drive the models that estimate how much pasture biomass is in a paddock.
Why use satellites and remote measuring as part of this toolkit that you have for farmers?
Current technology means that farmers have to walk around the farm once a week, say, and that takes 2 to 3 hours to measure the whole farm. So by measuring by satellite, we can remove that labour or transfer that labour to another part of the farm. Another reason why to use satellite technology or to use remote measuring is due to the fact that not many farmers measure their pasture today, and that is due to limitations in resources such as time. It is a revolutionary tool that's absolutely going to lift farmers' productivity and increase that competitive edge that we have for growing pasture.
Just how new is it, this idea of using satellites to measure pasture growth?
Satellites have been measuring pasture growth for years now. So there are services out there using NDVI. The new part is, which is a world first, is using a feedback model or using feedback in neural nets to make more precise estimations of pasture biomass in paddocks. And that's where it gets really exciting, because instead of measuring just the greenness of a paddock to get biomass, we're actually using farm records and turning boring farm records into something that's meaningful, which in itself provides a platform for encouraging farmers to make use of farm records and to actually record what they do to make better decisions moving forward, which in a sense makes that farmer more robust.
Is that the new frontier for ag tech, is converting that, not just capturing the data and coming up with the technology to capture that data, but to actually make it work for the person who's making the decisions?
The important part about the data is that it talks in the farmer's language. It talks in kilograms of dry matter per hectare. It talks in megajoules of energy. It talks in the farmer's language of a feed wedge. It doesn't talk in terms of displaying a colourful image and saying, there, go and make your own analysis of this picture. It actually gives meaningful data that is interpreted in a meaningful way that gives a really good visual representation of a farm. And with that visual representation, you can quickly assess, is the farm going into a surplus or is it going into a deficit? And they're very important observations to make, especially as you move into towards winter when growth rates are slowing, or towards spring as growth rates start accelerating and cows are calving down.
What can you tell me about how the technology you've designed is being used in schools?
The Pasture.io platform is a partner of the Smart Farm Learning Hub, which is all about streaming live data from real farms directly into classrooms. So it's really exciting for the next generation of students going through university or even high school or college to be able to tap into the Smart Farm Learning Hub and access platforms like the Pasture.io platform for seeing real-life data that's flying off farms and into their classroom so they can sit there and make these real-life decisions based on someone else's data. Like, that's really cool.
What would that have meant for you?
What it would mean for me, instead of sitting there looking at a program about modelling hypothetical data or for making strategic and tactical decisions, would actually be sitting there looking at a data set going, wow, this data is from someone's farm today, and this is what their farm looks like, and I'm about to make management decisions on this farm as though I'm on the farm myself. Now, that's quite powerful.
Oliver Roberts from Flowerdale in the States Northwest and founder of Pasture.io. He's a University of Tasmania alumni now partnering with the Smart Farm Learning Hub initiative with seven universities across Australia. Well, let's stay with ag tech. Horticulture Innovation is investing in research to develop robots for apple orchards. Swarm Farm Robotics in Queensland currently has robots to work in broadacre agriculture, and now we'll look at applying the autonomous robots in intensive orchards. Campbell Newman, former Queensland Premier from Swarm Farm, says the next revolution in agriculture is going to be driven by technology.
The paradigm of the last sort of 50 years has been bigger, heavier, more complex machines covering huge acres per unit of labour each day. Plus, of course, the use of agricultural chemicals and fertilisers and, you know, plant breeding, even GMOs, to get higher yields. But yields are plateauing. And if we continue to grow agriculture to feed a growing world population, we need to change the way that we're farming. And so the concept of swarm farming developed by Andrew and Jossie Bate in central Queensland at Emerald is about small, lightweight, low-cost machines that are deployed 24/7 in the fields undertaking all the agricultural tasks. So, well, ultimately these machines, these multi-purpose machines, these platforms will plant the seed, apply the agricultural chemicals very, very precisely, and maybe even irrigate them as well, and ultimately do the harvest of the crop. So the full cropping cycle undertaken by these machines.
Let's describe those machines, because you had some illustrations. They're pretty much rigs that farmers would relate to. They're something they could put a spanner on, not like some of the really sophisticated software-driven, very expensive tractors. They've got a payload of between 450 and 600 kilograms of potential water or chemicals. Can you just describe how they're made and how nimble they are?
Well, these machines have been developed from, if you like, the grass, sort of grassroots up. They were literally designed by a farmer for farmers. Really, I suppose they look perhaps in some ways like a lightweight tractor, but really they're a multi-purpose platform. So the idea is this machine can have different attachments put on it. It's diesel-powered. Ultimately, these things will be electric and, you know, have solar panels, etc., but there's some time, I think, for the technology to catch up. But the idea is this machine can go out in a field and perform a range of tasks depending on the attachments or the application that individual farmers have chosen to develop. And we want farmers to think of solutions to problems that they have on their farm, and then get the local young person who's into computers and robotics to actually develop that new app. So there's some really interesting things that could go on in rural communities.
Now, we know that data and data speed in parts of Australia, regional Australia, is not great, given that these are autonomous vehicles. Do you think that's going to be an impediment?
Look, the issue of getting coverage, data coverage across your farm, is one of the big things for ag technology. Just put aside robotics, this is specific. Whatever the technology, whether it's sensors for weather conditions, soil moisture, soil condition, etc., you need coverage right across your farm. Now, the telcos that we've spoken to have a dream or an aspiration to be able to provide that using their cellular system, and there's 4G at the moment, 5G is coming. We're a bit dubious about that because the nature of farming country is that you have hills, you have hollows, valleys, and we don't think telcos will be able to cover every square metre of a farmer's farm. So we think ultimately what's going to happen is people will deliver low-cost Wi-Fi networks or mesh broadband networks that a farmer can put into their farm, cover every square metre, be able to deploy the robots, be able to deploy the sensors and get that total coverage. Then, of course, there needs to be a link into the ultimate cloud, the internet, and that's something that the telcos should do. So that's our view of the world. If the telcos can do it, if they can cover every square metre of someone's farm, that'd be great. The trouble is if they don't, in this new world, a farmer can't accept not having 100% coverage because then he or she cannot farm 100% of the farm.
Campbell Newman from Swarm Farm. Swarm Farm Robotics co-founder Andrew Bates says the orchard robots will have cameras which will access tree size, canopy and the number of flowers on each tree.
You know, originally Swarm Farm was founded on broadacre and row crop agriculture. We've always had a big view for our technology about other crops we can take it into, from sugarcane through to tree crops and forestry into horticulture and cotton and other crops as well. And there was an opportunity in the apple industry to look at flower thinning and flower counting methods on onboard robots and autonomous machines to take on that challenge. And we put together a team to do that, and we're pretty excited to be involved.
So tell us a little bit about the trial.
So basically, the project is to develop cameras and vision processing algorithms that can count the number of flowers on the trees, and also to go beyond that into the agronomy and actually look at the model in terms of flower thinning decisions, in terms of how that a flower count actually carries through to a thinning operation. So look at the weather and other factors involved in that, and then taking that all the way through to a variable rate spray tree by tree, which would take into account the size of the tree and the size of the canopy as well as the actual flower load as well. Smaller trees can get a lower volume than larger trees that require a higher volume of spray, and also varying the dilution of the spray on the fly as we're going down the rows. So.
And I understand this work's going to be, or likely to be, in Victoria?
Look, based in Victoria, but we'll take the technology across the apple-growing regions. There's no point developing a solution for one crop, one situation. So we'll have a home base there, but we'll bring the technology to other orchards across the country to show how the technology works, in different varieties and different growing regions, because, each region has its own quirks in terms of weather and crop growth.
And what about in New Zealand?
Haven't made any plans to travel across the ocean yet, but...
But this technology would have international implications, would it not?
Oh, absolutely. I guess the important thing is the reality is it's early stage in terms of flower counting, and, we're here to make this work and provide something of value to farmers. And I'm a farmer myself, and you see so much technology that's all talk or all research and none of it actually hits the road and lands on the farm. And, this project is run by an agronomist, not a scientist or a robot engineer. It's actually run by an agronomist. And we're very proud of our team at Swarm Farm. All of our team have dirt on their boots. They live in agriculture. All of our staff are based on farm or in agricultural areas, not in capital cities. And
so it's a little bit blue sky at this point, but obviously Hort Innovation see it as having potential?
Yeah, look, I think the blue sky research has been done for flower counting. You know, the technology's out there. It's a matter of making it practical and something that farmers can use. And, I think we're on a three-year sort of time frame to get that delivered through to something that actually can be used by a farmer. And that's what Swarm Farm set out to do in this project.
Andrew Bate, who along with his wife Josie are from Swarm Farm Robotics from Emerald in Queensland. That's Monday's Country Hour. Hope you can join me again tomorrow from midday. It's news time, 1 o'clock.